Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Gillian Flynn is best known as the author of Gone Girl. She also wrote the screenplay for the film version. Since then, Gillian has written more for the big and small screen. She co-wrote the screenplay for the 2018 film Widows, as well as the TV adaptation of her book Sharp Objects. She also wrote the series Utopia, which will be released this year on Amazon. I spoke to Gillian at the Traverse City Opera House in April 2013. She told me she loved macabre stories since she was a child, when her father played her movies that were possibly inappropriate for her age.
You know, I have a distinct memory of him, like, with that giant 70s top-loading VCR and putting the tape and like, Gilly, you know, today we're watching Psycho. You know, like, begin! And, you know.
Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
How old were you?
I was about 8 or 9.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. I loved it. I loved it. I think, like, this says something really weird about me, but Anthony Perkins was, like, one of my first crushes from that movie.
Well, didn't you also practice the Norman Bates smile in the mirror? I was going to ask you to do that. Now
I got pretty good at it. I was convinced we were gonna find each other somehow.
Do you have any recollection about what it was about Psycho and movies like that and that genre of quote horror that attracted you? Because you seem like a very nice person, and and you are, and so deserving of this enormous success you've had this year. I mean, I asked the question because I think, you know, this book alone is probably, your publisher told me, sold 2 million copies. Tell us what you think Gone Girl is about and why people are responding. I've been hanging around with you, and I'm hearing what people tell you, and it's just interesting.
To me, it's I wanted to write a book about long-term relationships. I had written my first two books and they had narrators and characters who had a lot of trouble making any sort of connection. They were very isolated people, and I felt like I had explored that very well, that territory of loneliness and what that meant to a person. And so I wanted, being a newlywed at the time, it seemed like a good idea to to just get in there and see what it was all about. And I did, you know, luckily I have a very, very cool husband.
His name is Brett Nolan, uh-huh. He's a lawyer in Chicago.
That's right. He's not a writer, but he's someone who loves writers. He loves reading. He reads like 8 books a week. And he just said, you know, he's like, write the book that you want to write. Don't censor yourself. Like, do it, do, you
what
know.
What does he read?
He likes a lot of mysteries. He reads dark stuff too, and a lot of nonfiction.
And you read this?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Did he ever say to you, you stole a line from me, or that's an argument we had, or something like that?
You know, I was very careful, and that was one of those things that I was, wanted to be really aware of early on, was, you know, what I say, don't drive angry, like, don't write angry. Like, every once in a while we'd have an argument, I'd be like, uh-huh. You think you're right about that? You know. Then I'd have to delete, you know, because I did not want to do that to us. And at the end, he reads, he's my first and best reader, and he reads all along. So he kind of was reading big chunks at a time. And before I sent it off to the publisher, I said, you know, read it one more time and just read it for us. And like, let me know if there's anything that feels too close to home. And he said, well, it kind of all feels too close to home. Like, you know, isn't that the point? You know, like, that, don't you want to make spouses kind of look at each other a little bit, you know, off? And he didn't highlight anything. He said, send it off.
You have a plaque in your office, right? Leave the crazy here.
Yeah, leave the crazy downstairs. Yeah.
What does that mean? It goes back to that don't write angry?
It goes back to, you know, I write dark stuff. And so it does kind of infect your mood. And especially if you're writing these, you know, really intense emotional scenes. You know, I have my offices in the basement of our house, and you know, I don't want to bring that mood upstairs with me. And so, yeah, that was the joke is, you know, leave the crazy downstairs. So what I learned to do, especially with Gone Girl, is about 10 minutes before I was done for the day. Yeah, I do one of two things. I either play a game of Galaga, which always relaxes me, or I'll go on YouTube and pull up a song and dance number from Singing in the Rain or something like that. And, you know, it's like Donald O'Connor and Gene Kelly. Like,
you really will do this.
I mean, Moses Supposes. That's the dance number I like to enjoy after a day of mayhem.
Wow. That's cool.
Yeah, it always makes me happy. It really does. It's like my go-to mood changer. And then I can go upstairs and be a normal person. Because for a while there, it was bad. Because, you know, my husband would come out, and I'd come upstairs like, hello. Like, you're home. And he's like, oh, I see you were writing today.
I mean, you call your basement the hell pit, right?
Yeah. It's really scary. It's a scary place.
But like it down there. You write with earplugs in, and
I'm not someone who could ever go to a coffee shop, or I don't like any sort of distractions. So it's, you know, kind of partway underground, and it's cold. I have this little space heater next to me, like Bob Cratchit. You know, I'm kind of huddled over it, writing, and it's kind of off it's this finished room that's off an unfinished basement that literally has like a root cellar next to it that's not used for anything except for, I'm sure, where the serial killer is does live, who is one day going to come out with the chainsaw and get me. Then this is my writing day. And so, wow. And then at the end I run back upstairs. I'm like, killer.
And your two-year-old says to you, Mama, or what?
He doesn't. He says
he doesn't know.
He's like, Mama's home. Hey.
Yeah.
No, people ask me all the time. You know, like, what are you gonna do? You know, what are you gonna think when your son reads? You know, is old enough and he reads your books? And I'm like, he's a kid. No kid ever wants to know what their parents do. He's never gonna read anything
That's
I write.
True.
He's gonna be like, oh, Mom, don't make me read that.
Yeah. That. So let's talk about the. I mean, what did you learn about your own self and perhaps marriage by writing Gone Girl? Because I think, you know, it's a story about, I think what you do really so brilliantly and so in such entertaining fashion is write about when the social contract crumbles, you know, and people start to misbehave. And it's really that fight to kind of put everything back together.
Okay.
We see Amy do that, you know, in the mm-hmm. book. So what did you learn about
the mystery
of marriage, as you say?
Yeah. I started with that idea of how truthfully anyone can and fully know each other. I liked the idea of that cliche, you know, no one knows what happens in other people's marriages, and I wanted to twist that just a little bit more and say, you know, does anyone know what goes on in their own marriage, and how well do we know each other? And I liked the idea that, you know, we're all playing some sort of con game with each other no matter what, that, you know, when you meet someone and you like them, you're not going to show them all the weird, creepy stuff about you. You're going to put your best self forward. You know, you hear that phrase all the time, be your best self. And it's like, well, that means lie. Like, you're lying a little bit.
I have a question. How many dates into your dating with your now husband, Brett, was it before you did the Norman Bates smile?
It was date one. That's how I knew it was he's a keeper.
Wow, really? No.
It was two. It was date two.
Two. Wow. That's cool. So this idea of the of knowledge and self-knowledge and the book Gone Girl really, I mean, it's an unpeeling of that onion.
Yeah, exactly. It's going, you know, further and further. And as you said before, also playing with that idea of an authentic self. Like, how much do you peel back? Because anytime we're telling our life story, even if we're not deliberately being manipulative, deliberately being conniving, we're telling a story. We're choosing to tell a certain specific narrative that we have chosen to package together. I'm from here, I do this. You're putting forth a certain things and leaving other things beside. And I like the idea of these two narrators who are very good at their own self-mythology and very good at telling their version of the love story and also the unraveling of the love story as these kind of dueling narrators. And, you know, as you start peeling them back, you realize what, you know, they're very upfront that they're kind of unreliable narrators, and you're kind of peeling them back and trying to figure out where that real self is. And I do think it's a time period right now in which it's harder and harder to be a very original and authentic person because we're, and I say this for myself also, you know, we're so barraged by references to movies and mm-hmm. songs and the internet and what people think about certain things. And we have all these different voices in our head. And as Nick mentions in our book, we're all working from some sort of a similar script. We know what to say when a bad thing happens. We know what to say when people are married. You know, we're working from these very similar sort of lines and thoughts and references and things we've seen before. And I think that, you know, normally the first thing that comes out of your mouth is something you've kind of heard before.
It's the world of Entertainment Weekly. It's that world of homogenous television and entertainment that, mm-hmm. right? That's why I was curious if wandering around that world for yeah. a year might have telegraphed some of that to you. Mm-hmm. You had a really happy, you said you had a
yeah.
happy childhood. I mean, this and the dark stuff with your dad and the psychos, because it was happy and it
yeah,
was sane.
Exactly.
It was sane and it was balanced.
Yeah, yeah, no, yeah. exactly. It was a very, I think, you know, and plenty of kids grow up in happy, you know, pretty normal households and don't like to explore those dark places.
Right.
So I'm not sure exactly what it was. But I do know, I think that the fact that at the end of the day, I could go back to this very safe and happy place. But, you know, from very early on, you know, I grew up with kind of a bunch of cousins, a big extended family. And there were a bunch of us girls who were about the same age. And we'd play imaginary games all the time. And, you know, we'd dress up clothes and stuff. And it was always like, I'm going to be the princess. And I'd be like, I will be the witch. Because the witch is so much more interesting than the princess. Why would anyone want to be the princess? She has no backstory. You know, she's good and pretty.
Yeah.
Witch is where it's at.
Your character, Libby Day, you said you wrote her early on as a really healthy kind of princess kind of character, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, quote, I hated her.
Yeah.
That's what you said about her.
Yeah.
And you let her be the anti-hero that she was meant to be in your novel. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to me that you said that you like to write about women who can't be easily dismissed. What do you mean by that? And why is that important, that idea of a femininity that is has some ferocity to it?
Yeah, I don't necessarily set out to write bad women. And in fact, that was, Libby was, after coming off of Sharp Objects, where I already had a troubled dark female narrator. I was kind of determined not to, you know, I was like, I don't want to do that. You see how well that has worked out
right,
for me.
Yeah.
and I, you know, I wrote her completely incorrectly. I wrote her in the way that character did not feel remotely real. And I went back and I deleted everything with her and I started over again and wrote her with, I found the opening, her opening line, which is the opening line of the book, which is, I have a meanness inside me, real as an organ. Draw my soul and it would be a scribble with fangs. And I was like, now I know who Libby is. Okay, I got it. For me, I really, the thing I push against the most is the idea that women are innately good.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that robs us of a certain amount of free will. It sort of says that when we choose to be good, that it's only because of our anatomy or something that's built chemically within us. And I think that's really untrue and really boring. And so I like to write women who sometimes find it hard to do right. You know, Libby finds it very, very hard to do mm-hmm. the right thing. She sometimes gets there and often doesn't. Amy obviously has her own issues,
right.
but and women who choose to do wrong. But I think that sense of a more complicated person, you know, and it gets a certain amount of attention, which I think says something odd about us still, you know, that the fact that, you know, men very often write about troubled male characters. That's a
right.
very, very, very common theme. And to me, I just think, you know, women are a vast array of good and evil, and I'd like to show all of it.
And they're not victims. I mean, that's one of
yeah.
the subtexts of your argument, right?
That, yeah, that, yeah.
That it's...
There's often that, victimizers,
they can
yeah.
be victimizers, yeah.
yeah.
Is that part of this idea of the inauthentic self, that you feel that contemporary American culture is bombarding young girls, perhaps, with this idea that they are innately good or should be? Or explore that a little bit.
Yeah.
What do you mean by the idea of
femininity? I think That is, you know, I certainly am someone who struggles to make right choices. I think, you know, normally I get there, but I also would like credit for it.
Yeah. What do you mean? What kind of choice are you talking about?
I think my first instinct is often to do the selfish thing, you know, whatever's easiest for me. I'm not confessing that I have a bloodlust and will to kill on stage. And that's what you're wondering?
No.
Here, what kind of things do you...
Here, Annie, have some water.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, more of Doug Stanton's conversation with Gillian Flynn, author of Gone Girl.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to my conversation with Gillian Flynn.
This idea of violence is so interesting to talking with you because we do live in a very violent time and in a violent, certainly in America. And as I sit and talk with you, I realize that's really what you're writing about. It. I think in some ways it's the nature of violence and innate violence or whatever the opposite of that is. But you said something interesting about, you know, you'd like to write about violence, the certain kind of bursts of violence that might unite people. Mm-hmm. I think that's a quote, and I'm not going to ask you to remember when you said that, but something about that idea of being united around that.
The communities that come from an interest in a certain crime, or that was
is that
certainly
what you meant? Yeah.
Certainly that was part of it. I've always been interested in the idea that violence often can only happen on a certain time and a certain place with certain people together. And when you look back at certain crimes, you think, oh, those very specific personalities hadn't found each other. You know, like as I said, with In Cold Blood and Truman Capote.
Right.
You think about, you know, those two people hadn't found each other and this hadn't happened, the way different personalities push each other toward violence. And then the other thing I have always been interested in is why certain crimes become such an object of public fascination.
Mm-hmm.
And the communities that really do grow up around these crimes online. And part of it's the idea of solving it, if it's you know, within doubt of what happened. But a lot of it is really connecting and finding a way to connect over these real tragedies.
Yeah, that's right. There's a community that kind of coalesces around. I mean, think of the Lacey case? You, Scott?
Mm. And Lacey Peterson, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that people became very, you know, very, very invested
and
in that.
Nick and Amy's own drama in your novel is, I mean, they have a tent, a search tent, and hot tip line and all that.
Yeah, it's very, I mean, I wanted to construct that so it felt very much like something you would flip on the TV and see the way that we package tragedy for a news cycle.
So given these ideas, you know, you had a job as a reporter for 10 years writing about popular culture, and you knew what that job was. It was to dramatize and describe what's going on. What's your job as a novelist now, given the ideas that we're talking about? What are you reporting on?
You know, I like to just try to figure out our world a little bit more, and I think that's why a lot of people read. I mean, I always tell people that I'm not someone who's going to write a hero's narrative. That if you want a lesson, a very specific lesson to be learned or a very specific object to be overcome, I'm probably not the writer for you. I read and I write because I'd like to figure out how we all interact with each other and why certain things happen. I like to write about the nature of socioeconomy and a sense of place and what coming from a certain place means to people and relationships and our ability to come together and why they fall apart and so for me, that's, I think, my goal is to, you know, you couldn't give me a bigger compliment than to say that you recognized a person or you recognized a thing or a certain moment was articulated that resonated with you. I mean, that's my goal, and that's why I've always read.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, you know, I think of the abandoned shopping mall in Gone Girl as a metaphor for so much, you know, and a collapsed economy and a collapsed community, really. But I know the Midwest is important to you, that it's not flyover country, as it isn't for all of us listening as well, and that you feel that there's certain values and themes and untold stories in this territory. What are some of those?
Yeah, no, I think it's the great unexplored section, certainly in literature. You know, for me, part of it is taking advantage as a writer of the strange, almost exotic otherness that I think the middle of the country has for people on the coast. I mean, I know when I lived in New York, people found it so strange that I was from Missouri. I mean, it was such a novel.
Oh, wait, did you say Missouri? Or did you? Yeah.
Yeah. And also that I mispronounced it.
No, that's it.
You know, and I found I could get away with certain, you know, I'd be like, that's how we do it in Missouri. You know, you could almost get away with anything because they'd be like, I respect your culture. You know, like, you know, it'd be like, well, you know, on Tuesdays, if you're from Missouri, then people from New York give you $5 and buy, and they buy you pancakes. That's just how it's done. And be like, oh, okay. So for part of it really is the roaming space that it gives for a writer to, you know, it's harder to write about New York. It's harder to write about LA or even Chicago because they've been written about a lot. And for me, my books do, I like to tiptoe up to the edge of Gothic a little bit. I like to kind of tell oversized stories, and writing about that middle of the country kind of gives me that room.
What's your area? Like if you look at the map, show us the map, draw a circle.
I would say, you know, the farthest east I've ever gone was Hannibal and St. Louis and Gone Girl, down into the boot heel of Missouri, down to the south and along there in Kansas, and out kind of in the middle of Kansas. And, you know, that's a part of the country. I mean, there's so much there. I mean, I like, particularly being from Kansas City, it really does have a little, you know, it's got a little southern to it. It's got
it
a
does,
little
yeah.
west to it. You know, you can drive 2 hours in almost any direction and feel like you're in a very different place.
Yeah, you kind of have it to, you kind of have this area to yourself in a way. You think of Willacather in Nebraska or Faulkner in Mississippi, Flynn in Flynnville, which is those areas you just...
That's counties.
Yeah. If you were to meet someone who'd never been to the United States or read a newspaper or saw a U.S. television show, how would you describe to them the story you think we're trying to tell about ourselves today in America? I mean, think about what are the tensions, that are the dramatic tensions kind of in what it means to be a citizen right now? Because I think it goes to the question of what we've been talking about. But I'm always curious about this when we talk. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's a strangely divisive time when often it shouldn't be. You know, we do have all this media and we do have all this access to different viewpoints and different thoughts and everything. At the same time, we're choosing more and more and more to be in different encampments, men versus women and red state versus blue state and us versus them and all this sort of deliberately closing ourselves off and creating this conflict instead of actually taking advantage of what the world is offering us right now, which is the ability to see quite a bit. But, you know, I think more and more of those stories that we're hearing do really come down to us, me, you.
Right, falling into our slots.
Yeah.
And not paying attention. Talk to me about writing Gone Girl just for a moment. When we talked about you being down in the hell pit and tap dancing when you're done. Is it enjoyable? We have a lot of writers in the audience. And what would you tell them? I mean, first, is it enjoyable for you? And how'd you keep going? Because I know at one point you were composing the book and it wasn't going well. I think it might have been the birth of your son might have been involved in there somewhere in the middle of that. How'd you keep on?
You know, I think, first of all, do I like it? Some days I love it and some days I can't stand it. You know, some days I would rather do almost anything in the world because you just feel like you're putting so much energy and so much work and thought into it, and at the end of the day, you're gonna have to throw it out. Like there are those days where you just know you've spent 8 hours of very, you know, not physically hard work, but you know, of brain energy, and it's just not going your way. what a lot of writers do is say, like, I'll just go on the internet and do a little research for a little bit. And, you know, there's usually, for me, there's no quicker sign that I'm not doing my job as when I'm researching things that, you know, don't need to be researched. It's like, what does this kind of car look like? It's like, it doesn't matter. Just write the story. You know, what does, I'll spend for hours, I love naming characters. That's my usually, like, I love figuring out everyone's name, and I'll go on the Social Security has this great website where you can go on and you can find the most popular names in a certain year in a certain region, and, you know, I'll go down that rabbit hole for hours.
How about Boney and Gilpin? Where did those names come from? They're characters in Gone Girl.
Yeah. Gilpin was just I thought that was a good area name. I had met a lot of people in and out with that last name for whatever reason. Boney, I like the idea of Nick always, that even in the middle of this murder investigation, he's like, I'm at a ground in Bona Maroney. Like, I like that idea that he's in the middle, like his wife is missing, and he still can't get that ear war. Like, he's still singing that song. And the name Tanner Bolt is actually that's my husband's name. It's an anagram.
So, oh, that's so sweet, yeah.
He was also in Dark Places, too. He was a tiny Oklahoman who wore cowboy boots and ran a home for wayward men.
And he was named?
Bert Nolan. Bert Nolan's Home for Wayward Men.
That's funny. Who are you rooting for in this book? You don't have to give away the ending, but I'm just curious, talking about the idea of the authentic self, and because I know you're answering some need by writing this book, I think. It's written, it has such an urgency to it. There's such a, and it moves so quickly. I mean, you told me you wrote this book twice and cut half of it off, and this is the part that got published, so it wasn't easy, right? But who are you rooting for in the novel?
I'm rooting for whoever's chapter I'm in at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and that's exactly what I wanted it to feel like. That, again, there are no, it's not a hero's journey. It's not a story that's going to lead you to a conclusion that says, and justice, you know, because I don't think life is like that. I don't think relationships are like that. And I don't think that was what I was trying to do. But what I knew I wanted to do was that when you're with Nick, you're kind of siding with him a little bit. And when you're with Amy, you're kind of pulled back and forth. And that sense of that you are being manipulated by two people who have some likability. I think they both have a sense of humor and certain facts of awareness that make them interesting, at least.
You know, hearing you talk, I wonder, do you think this book is part satire? Because it's a send-up, in a way, of the Amy character, and it's a send-up of the Nick character. I mean, it's peering back on itself. It's self-referential. And you keep saying there is kind of no hero, or there's no... There is a moment when you arrive and you say, you know, this may not be the way to live your life. I mean, even in the simplest manners of always being a consumer rather than a creator. These are consumers, right? Mm-hmm. These are people kind of just are walking around consuming things and not being original. Is that?
Yeah, they are. And when those articles by which they've constructed their lives start peeling away, I think that is when they actually first start having that sort of trouble. They've been used to playing the golden people and being the golden people. And when the career and the house and the locale and all these things start pulling away from them, you know, that they are sort of left looking within, you know, what's left behind.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, if you haven't read the book, and you've got to read this book, but you'll see that Hannibal, you know, the whole Mark Twain, Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn, the idea of the great... journey through the middle of the country and the journey of transformation that happens in Huck Finn, that's now kind of a defunct amusement park in this novel, right?
Yeah.
So even that trope is gone, that these middle Americans in the beginning of a new century have kind of come, and the mall is turned in. The mall is like from The Walking Dead. I mean, it's filled, right? I mean, it's almost like the zombie apocalypse is going to happen in this mall.
As Nick says, who's watched too many zombie apocalypse movies, you know, he walks in and he's like, oh, awesome, I'm in a zombie apocalypse movie.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's very cutting, and it's, and do you think this book in particular, it's speaking to that, some anxiousness right now among men and women as they try as they try to remain married and try to make a living in this economy? Is that, mm-hmm. do you think that might be part of the...
I think there's a, I mean, I think that's why, and particularly these kind of books right now, I think of S.J. Watson's Before I Sleep, mm-hmm. And several other books that are much more about, you know, it's not the killer outside, it's the, that something weird, something's going wrong within the house. And I think because it is a kind of uneasy time, and it's an uneasy time in a way that we can't always put our fingers on or feel comfortable naming, you know, mm-hmm. that, you know, that there's things that we don't have control over, you know, the economy, global warming, all these, you know, fears that are roaming around there and what's going to happen and the state of relations, that combative feel that, again, you know, the media covered is so often mm-hmm. Putting forward, that there's everywhere you turn is kind of there's a certain uneasiness. And I think people like to look at that thing that's on their doorstep and be able to put a face to it. You know, I think mm-hmm. that's partly why these books are kind of becoming popular right now.
I know you've got more books to write, and you're this is, I think, the last stop as we opened here on a long tour. We're very happy that you've been here, and are here. But when you go back to work in May, how are you going to do that? talk a moment, because I want to have you in a moment just read something. Read some killer 3-4 minute passage so we can hear. I use that term only metaphorically. But how are you going to get back to work?
Yeah, you know, I have thought about this, how you write after this book, and I certainly wish that I had started writing a book before this one came out, so I had something that I was kind of pushing forward instead of pushing against. Yeah. And I think, you know, in a way, to me, the biggest part of the job now is to do what I did with my second book, which is to not push against the first book. You know, you finished your first book and you knew you could write it because you wrote it. And it was, you know, it was the one that you were probably thinking about the most and everything. And then you have to do your second one. And I at least spent a lot of time like, oh my gosh, is it too much like that one? Is it not enough like that one? How does it compare to that one? And that's how I ended up with that awful version of Libby. That first round of Libby was because I was writing directly in voice against sharp objects. And so I think my first and biggest job is to clear that voice and that worry out of my mind and just kind of just get back in my little creepy downstairs area and start writing.
You go down there?
Yeah, yeah.
You get up, make a pot of coffee.
Yeah.
Go down.
Drink a lot of coffee, drink too much coffee. Yep.
And I have one question. Joe, are you ready to cue that up?
Look. My songs!
One shot. One opportunity.
Thank you. I'm ready.
Okay, that's good. Thanks. All right. Good night. We have to go. She's got to go start the next book. But you would listen to that. Tell us who that song is.
That's Eminem. That's, yeah, when I was at my most desperate with Gone Girl, and I was just, I was like, I'm done. I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to write this book. I've forgotten how to write. And I went through a period where I would go downstairs, and I think it was like super pregnant at this point too, which makes it even more poignant. There's nothing more poignant than a really pregnant lady dancing to Eminem. And I put on and like just kind of like, yeah, I'm exactly got one shot. Do not miss your chance. And I would get to work. So,
oh, my back.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I gotta lie down. I'm so tired. Yeah, but it would really, that was one of those, I don't know how many times I listened to that, how many mornings.
That's great. the problem with, it was a hard book to write. I mean, I think you had probably so many arrows and places you were going.
Yeah.
I mean, the time structure alone is really a great reading experience, but I imagine it was hard to compose, so.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there was, you know, there's chronological issues, there's point of view issues, there's, you know, I would get hung up on certain scenes and then think like, oh right, that's a lie. That's a lie I don't need to worry about. Actually, because that's all made up, so I don't have to fact check that, you know.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
And unlike your time at Entertainment Weekly.
Yeah. But I do, since I do tell fairly outsized stories, for me it's really important to get the facts right, get the, you know, the police work right, yeah. Get the, you know, I would make sure the Ford Festiva was from the right year. Zima, I make a joke about them drinking Zima at their bar, and I'm like, okay, I have to make sure, like, when was
Zima
created?
Nobody drinks Zima anymore.
So I would if I could find some. I grew up on that.
Really?
I just created a fantasy land. It was a tricky, logistically, book to write, and my way of organizing when I write is to... if I have a thought about a character or a fact that I want to check or a storyline that I've, you know, want to double check, is I take out a yellow legal pad and scrawl a note that only makes sense to me. So I'll just be like, Festiva, yes, and I tape it to my wall. And then I tape another thing to my wall. And then I'll tape some more to my wall over here. And I forget to take them down as I check them. So by the end of Gone Girl, the whole room, it looked like a serial killer's lair. It was just like these fluttering pieces of paper that was going to be like, is mother dead? Is, you know, where's the Zima? Like just crazy person. And it also happens our only guest room is off my office.
Oh, that's
so
great,
people
yeah.
would come to visit and be like, welcome. The root cellar's over here and don't touch my notes. Sleep well. then I'd get my Norman Bates face.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Gillian Flynn reads from her novel, Gone Girl. Support for this broadcast provided in part by Becky Thatcher Designs, where you find jewelry to commemorate the landmarks in your life, at their stores in Leland, Harbor Springs, Glen Arbor, and Traverse City, and on the web at BeckyThatcherDesigns.com.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to my conversation with Gillian Flynn.
What's interesting, though, after your two books, which did very well, kind of critically, and I think Dark Spaces was on the Times list for 2 weeks or 2 months. I mean, it didn't...
I think it was like one, yeah, one and off.
Oh, we'll just say 2 weeks.
Okay, thanks. Yeah.
But yet, you're there in the basement, and you're pregnant, and you're dancing the Eminem because you think you've got one shot.
Yeah.
I mean, it never really gets any easier, does
no.
it, to write?
Mm-mm.
And I imagine you might feel that same way with this fourth book, even though... you're in a different place. I mean, there's a sense that you've got to do it again.
I think that fear is a healthy thing. I think that people who want to do good at their jobs carry a certain amount of fear with them, no matter what that job is, because you want to do good at it and you want to challenge yourself. And it's only when you're trying to push yourself is when you get nervous. You know, if you're doing what you already know how to do, there's not that much of a fear factor. It's when you're trying to do something that you're not sure if you can pull off.
What's the thing you don't know how to do that you might try? You know, is it stylistic? Is it thematic?
Yeah, this last one was really plot intensive. I didn't think I could do that. You know, I do like to, you know, I like to push as far against the genre boundaries as I can and kind of try to reinvent what it means to be a novel. You know, I like working within that mystery and thriller and idea of it, but I also I don't like to play by all the rules necessarily.
I know. You said something interesting. I know Dennis Lehane, who is the author of Mystic River, among other great books, was an inspiration to you that for Dark Spaces, right?
Sharp Objects.
Sharp Objects. But in regards to that, you said that, you know, you think it's interesting that mystery writers are really tackling some important issues that other novelists may not be.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
Such as?
You know, I think they're telling some really, really interesting stories right now. And it was, you know, they're talking about places and socioeconomics and crime and guns and violence and family and all these very weighty, very interesting, very rich sort of topics. And there's nothing that drives me more crazy than when someone says, I don't read that kind of book. You know, no matter what kind of book it is. You know, I read Westerns, I read sci-fi, I read fantasy, I read, you know, mainstream psychology fiction, I read mysteries, because a good and smart story is a good and smart story.
Mm-hmm. What don't you read, though? I mean, of that.
I will admit...
I
will admit if it's a book about women shopping for shoes, I'm probably not going to, unless it's a really well-written book about women shopping for shoes.
Right.
Yeah.
So more of the domestic whatever.
Yeah, but if that's well done, I do.
You're
right.
Bullet lit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Listen, would you do this the favor of reading for a while in the voice of one of these characters so that we can kind of hear you and how maybe you heard them?
Sure. I'm actually just going to start with the opening of the book because I think that kind of sets the tone. So this is Nick Dunn. The day of.
Tell us a bit, Nick and Amy are.
Sure. So Nick and Amy are on their 5-year wedding anniversary. They are former writers. They used to live in New York, and that's where they met and had kind of a fairy tale courtship. Amy grew up with a strange iconic status because her parents wrote a book loosely inspired by her called Amazing Amy, and about a little girl who could kind of do no wrong. And Nick grew up a little more hard scrabble in Missouri and kind of fought his way to New York. Now they've both been laid off and they're back in his hometown. When I think of my wife, I always think of her head, the shape of it to begin with. The very first time I saw her, it was the back of the head I saw. And there was something lovely about it, the angles of it, like a shiny hard corn kernel or a riverbed fossil. She had what the Victorians would call a finely shaped head. You could imagine the skull quite easily. I'd know her head anywhere. And what's inside it? I think of that too, her mind, her brain, all those coils, and her thoughts shuttling through those coils like fast, frantic centipedes. Like a child, I picture opening her skull and spooling her brain and sifting through it, trying to catch and pin down her thoughts. What are you thinking, Amy? The question I've asked most often during our marriage, if not out loud, if not to the person who could answer. I suppose these questions storm cloud over every marriage. What are you thinking? How are you feeling? Who are you? What have we done to each other? What will we do? My eyes flipped open at exactly 6 a.m. This was no avian fluttering of the lashes, no gentle blink toward consciousness. The awakening was mechanical, a spooky ventriloquist dummy click of the lids. The world is black and then... showtime. 6:00, the clock said, in my face. First thing I saw, 6:00. It felt different. I rarely woke at such a rounded time. I was a man of jagged risings. 8:43, 11:51, 9:26. My life was alarmless. At that exact moment, 6:00, the sun climbed over the skyline of oaks, revealing its full summer angry god self. Its reflection flared across the river toward our house, a long, blaring finger aimed at me through our frail bedroom curtains, accusing, "You have been seen. You will be seen." I wallowed in bed, which was our New York bed in our new house, which we still called the new house, even though we'd been back here for 2 years. It's a rented house right along the Mississippi River, a house that screams suburban nouveau riche. the kind of place I aspired to as a kid from my split-level shag carpet side of town. The kind of house that is immediately familiar, a generically grand, unchallenging, new house that my wife would and did detest. Should I remove my soul before I come inside? Her first line upon arrival. It had been a compromise. Amy demanded we rent, not buy, in my little Missouri hometown, and her firm hope that we wouldn't be stuck here long. But the only houses for rent were clustered in this failed development, a miniature ghost town of bank-owned, recession-busted, price-reduced mansions, a neighborhood that closed before it ever opened. It was a compromise, but Amy didn't see it that way, not in the least. To Amy, it was a punishing whim on my part, a nasty, selfish twist of the knife. I would drag her caveman style to a town she had aggressively avoided and make her live in the kind of house she used to mock. I suppose it's not a compromise if only one of you considers it such, but that's what our compromises tended to look like. One of us was always angry. Amy, usually. Do not blame me for this particular grievance, Amy. The Missouri grievance. Blame the economy. Blame bad luck. Blame my parents. Blame your parents. Blame the internet. Blame people who use the internet. I used to be a writer. I was a writer who wrote about TV and movies and books, back when people read things on paper, back when anyone cared about what I thought. I'd arrived in New York in the late 90s, the last gasp of the glory days, although no one knew it then. New York was packed with writers, real writers, because there were magazines, real magazines, loads of them. This was back when the internet was still some exotic pet kept in the corner of the publishing world. Throw some kibble at it, watch it dance on its little leash. Oh, how cute, it definitely won't kill us in the night. Think about it, a time when newly graduated college kids could come to New York and get paid to write. We had no clue that we were embarking on careers that would vanish within a decade. I had a job for 11 years and then I didn't. It was that fast. All around the country, magazines began shuttering, succumbing to a sudden infection brought on by the busted economy. Writers, my kind of writers, aspiring novelists, ruminative thinkers, people whose brains don't work quick enough to blog or link or tweet, basically old, stubborn blowhards, were through. We were like women's hat makers or buggy whip manufacturers. Our time was done. 3 weeks after I got cut loose, Amy lost her job, such as it was. Now I can feel Amy looking over my shoulder, smirking at the time I've spent discussing my career, my misfortune, and dismissing her experience in one sentence. That, she would tell you, is typical. Just like Nick, she would say. It was a refrain of hers, just like Nick, too. And whatever followed, whatever was just like me, was bad. Two jobless grown-ups, we spent weeks wandering around our Brooklyn brownstone in socks and pajamas, ignoring the future, strewing unopened mail across tables and sofas, eating ice cream at 10 a.m. and taking thick afternoon naps. Then one day the phone rang. My twin sister was on the other end. Margot had moved back after her own New York layoff a year before. Margot, calling from good old North Carthage, Missouri, from the house where we grew up, and as I listened to her voice, I saw her at age 10, with a dark cap of hair and overall shorts, sitting on our grandparents' back dock, her body slouched over like an old pillow, her skinny legs dangling in the water, watching the river flow over fish-white feet, so intently, utterly self-possessed, even as a child. Go's voice was warm and crinkly even as she gave this cold news. Our indomitable mother was dying. Our dad was nearly gone, his nasty mind, his miserable heart, both murky as he meandered toward the great gray beyond. But it looked like our mother would beat him there. About 6 months, maybe a year she had. I could tell that Go had gone to meet with the doctor by herself, taking her studious notes and her slovenly handwriting, and she was teary as she tried to decipher what she'd written, dates and doses. I'll come back, Go. We'll move back home. You shouldn't have to do this all by yourself. She didn't believe me. I could hear her breathing on the other end. I'm serious, Go. Why not? There's nothing here. A long exhale. What about Amy? That is what I didn't take long enough to consider. I simply assumed I would bundle up my New York wife with her New York interests, her New York pride, and remove her from her New York parents, leave the frantic, thrilling future land of Manhattan behind, and transplant her to a little town on the river in Missouri, and all would be fine. I did not yet understand how foolish, how optimistic, how, yes, just like Nick, I was for thinking this, the misery it would lead to. Amy will be fine. Amy... Here was where I should have said, Amy loves Mom, but I couldn't tell Go that Amy loved our mother, because after all that time, Amy still barely knew our mother. Their few conversations had left them both baffled. Amy would dissect the conversations for days after. And what did she mean by, as if my mother were some ancient peasant tribeswoman arriving from the tundra with an armful of raw yak meat and some buttons for bartering, trying to get something from Amy that wasn't on offer. Amy didn't care to know my family, didn't want to know my birthplace, and yet for some reason, I thought moving home would be a good idea. My morning breath warmed the pillow, and I changed the subject in my mind. Today was not a day for second-guessing or regret. It was a day for doing. Downstairs, I could hear the return of a long-lost sound, Amy making breakfast, banging wooden cupboards, rump-thump, rattling containers of tin and glass, ding-ring, shuffling and sorting a collection of metal pots and iron pans, rose-shouge, a culinary orchestra tuning up, clattering vigorously toward the finale, a cake pan drum-rolling across the floor, hitting the wall with a symbolic crash. Something impressive was being created, probably a crepe, because crepes are special, and today, Amy would want to cook something special. It was our 5-year anniversary. I walked barefoot to the edge of the steps and stood listening, working my toes into the plush wall-to-wall carpet Amy detested on principle, as I tried to decide whether I was ready to join my wife. Amy was in the kitchen, oblivious to my hesitation. She was humming something melancholy and familiar. I strained to make it out, a folk song? A lullaby? And then I realized it was the theme to MASH. Suicide is painless. I went downstairs. I hovered in the doorway watching my wife. Her yellow butter hair was pulled up, the hank of ponytail swinging cheerful as a jump rope, and she was sucking distractedly on a burnt fingertip, humming around it. She hummed to herself because she was an unrivaled botcher of lyrics. When we were first dating, a Genesis song came on the radio. She seems to have an invisible touch, yeah. And Amy crooned and said, she takes my hat and puts it on the top shelf. When I asked her why she'd ever think her lyrics were remotely, possibly, vaguely right, she told me she always thought the woman in the song truly loved the man because she put his hat on the top shelf. I knew I liked her then, really liked her, this girl with an explanation for everything. There's something disturbing about recalling a warm memory and feeling utterly cold. Amy peered at the crepe sizzling in the pan and licked something off her wrist. She looked triumphant, wifely. If I took her in my arms, she would smell like berries and powdered sugar. When she spied me lurking there in grubby boxers, my hair in full heat miser spike, she leaned against the kitchen counter and said, "Well, hello, handsome." Bile and dread inched up my throat. I thought to myself, "Okay, go."
Wow.
That was Gillian Flynn talking with Doug Stanton. Gillian Flynn is the author of Gone Girl and a number of screenplays for film and TV. Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.